We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the Prep to Pro NBA Draft Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Max Carlin, and I'm joined, as always, by Jake Rosen. Jake, how are you doing?
I'm doing well today, Max. How are you?
I am all right. Well, actually, I'm excited because we finally have the return of Mr. Prospect Development Web to talk about developing prospects. PD, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It feels good to be off my band. back on the airwaves. My suspension's been lifted. I'm excited to talk about this draft.
Yeah, the totally real PD shadow ban has been lifted. All right, let's get into talking about developing the prospects of the 2021 NBA draft. So we're starting with some guys who need some skill / tendency development. And we're just going to talk about, how we go about trying to develop these players. So the first that we have is actually a pair. And we kind of teased this in the past with Jaden Springer and Keon Johnson of Tennessee. Petey, do you want to get into a little bit of the tendency that kind of pervades the entire Tennessee roster as drivers and kind of what you would do with each of these guys to start to address it?
Yeah, the Tennessee... And I guess this is sort of an offshoot of the Villanova style, is that you recruit stronger guards, and when they are, I would say, less than a step ahead of the defense, you have them like Villanova post up, which is where you half spin, and your guards can either change directions or just go into a straight up post up. It is certainly a style to stabilize offensive possessions. It pretty much ensures that your guards will never be rushed into decisions. It will... make sure that there's crackbacks to shooters on the weak side. And it can make possessions very groggy feeling, where you'll have like a sort of drive where under any other system, a floater would go up or a finish under pressure. The two things that show up most when you look up the stats is that neither has the volume of finishes possible, because so many of them have been aborted into this Villanova style post up. And then the second one is the ones that they do take are a lot simpler, so it can be difficult to judge the quality of finish within, because there's a triage of type of finishes that they're just not really allowed to take because of the system. Both are 2-foot finishers, so that's sort of the question, where it's like, how good of a finisher are you in the half court? And the system removes that possibility from the top. I've liked Springer as a finisher much better than Keon. I thought that Keon's true shooting percentage, while it was not good at Tennessee, had a floor that was much lower, and that the system in a lot of ways prevented him from having to make magic out of nowhere. I think that it also hurts both of them as just like free throw tanks, something that I thought that was an untapped potential. Again, like those half steps will bear difficult for coaches to trust with you with one and done college freshmen. Those are also circumstances where a lot of fouls would happen. So you lose a little bit in the efficiency, but you also, or you gain something in the efficiency, but you lose some in the foul drawing. I think that it's a matter of patience. I think the development is to get a floater, is to get stop, start finishes, is to add craft. I don't think that there's a distress for me among either one of them. I'm always curious how guards handle being in the system for 1 year with the Villanova guys. They don't generally recruit, you know, one and done guards. If anything, it's wings. So how much of this they'll take and sort of turn into tricks in their pocket, and how much is sort of just cast aside is interesting. I think Keon is more likely to keep it than Springer is, but it's certainly an interesting trial for a type of guard that I think is going to be more present as Tennessee levels up in its ability to recruit guys like Springer and Keon.
Yeah, I think this really fits in line with what we talked about with Henry Ward a while ago about you know, context kind of obscuring actual ability. And this is, I don't even know if this is negative or positive in the case of Jaden and Keon, just that it certainly obscures their true finishing ability, their, you know, how they navigate that interior area. And at the college level, I think certainly well suited to their skills, particularly Jaden. But yeah, it does obscure the true ability on the interior. So I mean, Petey, how would you go about developing the floater game, developing the craft finishes, just developing the maneuverability on the interior for these guys after this year of defaulting to the Villanova style post-ups?
The wait is finally over. Football is in full effect and the NBA is back. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
I think attempts. I think that I would try to punish them as much as possible for doing them in practices and in summer league. Coming from a system where both of them hovered at 40% assisted, which is pretty unheard of for two guard prospects who can put overwhelming pressure on the rim. I would just say that they need, especially Springer needs to have the extension finish off two down pat, because he's more likely to be hip to hip with a half step or a quarter step and needing to extend as horizontally as possible. Similar to the adaptation that Donovan Mitchell made in his pre-draft section. Obviously that was a finishing leap pretty much unlike anything we've ever seen before, but that finishing package is essential for him. And I think that he has the free throw tank ability. It's just combining the ability to get horizontal with that and just changing his approach to say, like, look, you're going to have to get to the rim, and whoever drafts him, whatever outcome that may be, from the 20s that he's currently seen by some people to, you know, the high single digits from people like me, his ability to create and hold advantage is going to be essential for him turning into an important player in the future.
For Springer in particular, do you view it as like a necessity to excise the post-ups from his game, or do you think that it's something that he can still incorporate in there?
I would excise the percentage that he does the Villanova post-up, but I would love to invert offense. I think that if you have a big who can shoot, inverting your offense to get Springer mismatched on skinnier ones or skinnier twos. The defensive stock of twos is really, really thin. There's just not a lot of guys who can hold up physically at that spot in the league right now. And it's been a weakness of the league for, I would say, 6 or 7 years now, if not longer. And if you can invert an offense and get him with his butt to the basket, he can certainly operate there. I think that those skills have proven to be interesting in both playoff and winning contexts. And smart coaches have proven the ability to invert their offense. I just don't necessarily think that you can build an offense around the percentage of Villanova post-ups that they've had as an on-ball creator.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in real quick, because Max kind of took the question out of my mouth and PDU kind of took the words out of my mouth. I thought it was really interesting. And I do agree that, you know, Keon in the long term is more likely to rely on these post-ups at a higher volume, because I personally believe in Springer's handle and his ability to get to spots more free, like more often and more reliably than Keon. But I do think in the long run, as you mentioned, like inverting the offense, you know, one of Springer's calling cards is his overwhelming positional strength. That's only going to increase as he, you know, he's already young for his age and is moving guys off spots, moving wings, guards, bigger guards off spots. And I think, you know, as he continues to add strength, I think that could be an asset for him. He's very already really comfortable in the mid-range, does have good touch on those like little six-foot jumpers that he seems to love. So I do think, like, while I agree with you and 100% am behind it, that I think like the frequency and the volume should probably be cut down, I do think it's still going to be an effective avenue for him at the next level.
The next topic that we had to discuss was footwork. In this case, pertaining to Joe Wieskamp, but we talked about this a lot in the past as well, with especially with Killian Hayes, how I think PD, like a big, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but a big portion of what had to be cleaned up for Killian, particularly as a catch and shoot shooter, was the footwork, the setup there. And, you know, when he had that rhythm introduced off the dribble, he was much more comfortable shooting. But, you know, it's just kind of a mess off the catch. And the early run of games that he played before he got hurt this year, from what I remember, the footwork off the catch was still a bit of a disaster, and he was not able to make those shots. So, to correct someone like Killian's footwork, to correct someone like Wieskamp, who it like doesn't have poor footwork, I think he's just kind of inefficient setting shots up at times, and can sort of sacrifice windows to shoot there, especially for a guy who's not necessarily a bomber, who can be a bit hesitant with tight windows. So Petey, what are you doing to address footwork on these guys where where there's a lot to be gained from just cleaning that one aspect up?
So when you say footwork, is there a specific circumstance you feel like he loses out on most? Is there a specific footwork cadence that you've noticed most with him?
Not particularly, I don't think. I've been thinking like kind of recently about, again, from last year's class, Aaron Nesmith, who obviously was a really accomplished movement shooter last year, but I do think is pretty restricted in the like setups that he's comfortable with, that he wants to use like that flare footwork where you open up backwards. And that's kind of the only way he's comfortable shooting off movement. And like those like very nuanced differences need to be sussed out, because it does like severely limit kind of like the actual actions that you can be involved in. Which is just an entirely different tangent from this, but back to the issue of like correcting these things. How are we going about doing that?
I think that Nesmith and that tangent are actually really relevant, because with the times that I like Wieskamp the most is when he's operating out of like these sort of like floppy setups where, you know, you have two bigs low and he's sprinting away from the basket. I thought that his footwork there was very simple, and he was good at cutting his steps down, which is to say, like, you know, taking long strides and making sure that your feet are underneath you and you catch the ball on balance. And then the rest of it was also like messy, like in those circumstances, which are also like what Iowa runs the most, and their playbook isn't necessarily one that gives him five or six different catch approaches. It was usually that or a shake. Like, he was either catching it with negative momentum, where he had to execute these pretty difficult hip motivated, long stride motivated turns, or he was like simply sliding along. The thing that struck me the most in watching his footwork patterns is that like he gets into those settings pretty well. Like, he can catch and get square and get his legs underneath him and be on balance, but he gets out of those so messy. Like, his first step, even with people flying at him, just doesn't get anywhere. And I think that the most important thing for him at the next level is figuring out how to do damage with one step, because that's enough time for an NBA team to reset a rotation. So whether that's developing his hips to be able to sidestep and pull, whether that's working on his glutes and exploding forward, better step. I worry that teams are just going to run him off the line and live with whatever else happens. Like, part of why Joe Inglese works so well is that Joe is very good at making decisions in that half space in a way that, like, Wieskamp to me is not. So by tightening up the footwork, it can reduce his exposure to the elements that he's not as strong with. That being said, like, when teams did run him off the line and make him shoot in the short distance, like, he only got 10 of those shots up last year and he was poor doing so, according to Synergy's grading stats. So it's worth noting that while his shooting grades do look fantastic in catch and shoot and also a little bit off the bounce, when he's pushed into the areas that NBA teams will force him to, those were his weakest areas. And that should, I would say temper expectations, but realize that he's not going to be able to get the quality of look, and the book will be out much faster than what happened in college.
Yeah, at what point in a guy's career do you think that developing these different setups and then, in Wieskamp's case, like, these, I guess, like, footwork counters or progressions, at what point do you think that is no longer doable? Or alternatively, if you do think that it like remains doable, how do you go about doing that?
I mean, it's a confluence of factors. Having secondary or tertiary skills that complement the rotations and coverages that you're going to get is easier. So, like, I think that there's always going to be a difficulty in building a small set of game that will make him a great passer, but the ability to handle well in those circumstances, the ability to be calm under pressure into those circumstances, makes that transition much easier. It helps that he's not going to be asked to do a lot but those circumstances. Like, his only reads in his rookie contract are going to be reading closeouts and trying to create as much as possible out of them, whether it's continuing the rotation or knocking down the shot. I think that the physical development, the cleaning up of the varieties of footwork, and getting comfortable reading a 4-on-5 after a hard closeout are the essential bits. And those are things that the NBA, I feel like, has gotten pretty good at solving, or at least figuring out when to cut bait on guys who can't quite do it.
Jake, anything to add before we move on to Ariel Hakporti?
No, I mean, I haven't watched a ton of Wieskamp this year, so I'm a little bit less familiar with, you know, the specific instances in which he excels and the specific instances in which he needs work. But what I was intrigued with is your question, Max, is, you know, how feasible is this? We saw with Killian, and with Killian, something that I was really intrigued with last year, and which made me buy the catch and shoot, is that his off the bounce footwork was so potent. You know, he would bring out these hardened step backs, the double setback, side steps. He kind of had everything in his bag, and the footwork and balance was so impressive and so mature beyond his years. Yet then when you got to the catch and shoot stuff, like you said, it was an absolute disaster. So one question I would have for PD is, what would kind of explain that, and is excelling in one, does that have any correlation in future progression with the other, is kind of what I'm getting at.
I think the second question is easier to answer. And it's that we think of them as related skills, but they're different processes. Like, there are a ton of guys who are great catch and shoot guys who cannot shoot off the dribble, and vice versa. And part of it is how you're, you know, how you're wired. It's related to, you know, how your underlying shooting skills, your hand-eye coordination, your proprioception, like these things that make up the process of shooting, how developed they are, and that people are generally more or less suited to certain aspects of basketball, even within the subset of basketball players. So I think that you're going to have some uphill climb to get guys who are like great catch and shoot guys but can't shoot a lick off the dribble into being passable shooters off the dribble. That being said, like, I do think it's feasible. Like, I do think that you can do these things. And again, it's just finding the underlying skills to ease the burden on, you know, instead of making them a great shooter off the dribble. It's like, are you enough of a threat off the dribble that defenses have to rotate a certain way? Because if you're a good enough passer, then you can punish that rotation. Or if you're bad at two skills that are being presented at once, then like you, there's just, that's a hard place to stick in the league, being bad at simultaneous skills that are presented by a defense.
Can you get to like specific setups that mimic the one that you're good at enough to like basically trick your brain and body into thinking that you're either shooting off the dribble or shooting off the catch when you're really doing the other? Like, are there, you know, like one dribble pull up styles that are similar enough to shooting a spot up that you really are just mimicking that whole process?
So Max, before PD answers, if I could just say a quick nugget real quick, as you just triggered something in my mind with Kispert, this is something that I think is really interesting. When guys are pulling up, it's most common to see like this 1-2 hang dribble. A lot of Davion Mitchell hit a bunch yesterday. It allows for just a smooth energy transformation and rhythm. But Kispert is really interesting because off the bounce, he'll go to the hop very frequently, which is a little bit unusual. But as we know from watching all his movement attempts and catch and shoot attempts, he is much more comfortable. He'll show the 1-2 occasionally, but he is much more comfortable with that hop. So I know you're presenting a hypothetical, but I just did want to point out that Kispert is someone in this class, a high-level shooter, that does, I'm not sure if he's doing that intentionally, but I think it is probably worth noting that he is more comfortable off the hop. And then it's interesting that he takes a somewhat unorthodox approach off the bounce and has gotten pretty good results so far.
That was exactly what I was going to reference. Guys who have a specific gather style and mimic it off the bounce, even if it's a sacrifice of some of the quickness, like the hop off the bounce is a little bit slower, but if you can turn your release to be faster and you are that much more comfortable, the percentages do play out on a long enough timeline with enough work. So I think that there are tweaks that you can make to certain types of shooters, like guys who are really big left right and are left right going right, and that's their most comfortable way, like won't ever drive left. There are certain adjustments that can be made, and if that's a successful enough percentage play and an offense is good enough doing so, and a guy can pass good enough off his right, then the offense will just make it so that he is always spaced, that he doesn't have to go left to continue things. I know this was a problem that was discussed a lot with the Knicks, where like if RJ couldn't pass going to his right, how feasible is it to draft another lefty into the system? Which is like, again, a pretty deep concern. But it is adjustments that can be made if guys do have a specific problem with the way that they approach and the connecting skills when they run off the line.
Yeah, I think a curious theme that's kind of emerging here, though, is that we're not really presenting any solutions to, like, directly to addressing things like footwork concerns. It's all workarounds, right? Like, it's all, get better in this other area that can cover for it. Like, read the 5-on-4 better. It's all workarounds rather than, concrete ways to just, improve on the actual issue.
I think that it is difficult to present a lot of fixes with draft prospects because you don't necessarily know what their program is doing right now. So like without the knowledge of what Wieskamp was doing at Iowa, what he's doing in his off seasons, what he's done in high school, it's really difficult to propose solutions because the solution could be the thing that he's adopted for this this pre-draft. I think that a lot of it is obviously based on what happened prior, because sometimes guys will do things that just don't make any sense at their previous stop, and they get somebody who maybe is a little more attuned to current development methods, and suddenly they have a huge leap. That's certainly happened before, and it's difficult without seeing clips of Iowa practices or a historical observation. It's more of a shot in the dark and about my philosophy than what's actually going on with him.
Yeah, no, that certainly makes sense. PD, do you want to get into the weird pre-draft year that Ariel Hakkapurdi is having?
Yeah, this is going to be some crow that I'm eating on Ariel Hakkapurdi. Because I've for a long time said it's really important to give centers as much volume of playmaking as they can handle and to try to give them different pathways of development. Ariel Hakkapurdi is a center-sized human being and a very large center size. And he was used in a way that I think every draft Nick would have liked Kai Jones to be used. And it didn't go well. I would say with like, this is the double-edged sword of center responsibility, is that you want to add additional skills onto them, but you also don't want them to fall in love with additional skills because they can alter how they see their archetype. And suddenly they're not, you know, a 7-foot center, they're a 7-foot-2 guard. Not that that's what's going on with Okporty, but it's difficult to watch his games and think that he's going to be immediately comfortable going into like Mitchell Robinson's role. And doing this specifically in a draft year where teams look at, you know, some of these percentages and some of his output, like it's not normal for a player his size at the level he's playing at to have a 43 true shooting percentage or a 25% free throw attempt rate. But that's what you have to evaluate on, is this is a both a developmental year and an evaluative year. And that makes for a very odd combination for a player who has always seemed to be a project. I think that this is probably net positive long-term, unless he goes to a bad situation, then this is going to feel, like a prelude to something worse. I don't really have a takeaway from it, but just a note of how, delicate these, bigs with tools who could potentially have more are. And, you know, we've seen 4 or 5 guys who've had strange pre-draft years, and Mitch Robinson is certainly one of them. And how difficult it is to suss out the noise from the signal on them.
Yeah, I haven't watched much Okporty yet this year, but listening to your description of it, a couple things, like a couple of real takeaways do come to mind though. That one, I don't think that you have to totally punt on your give skilled bigs as much as they can possibly handle, because it sounds like Okporty to an extent was definitely given more than he could handle. It also makes me think that like this would be good if development and evaluation in young basketball players weren't so intertwined, that like if you could with no stakes give this situation developmentally to a big, then I don't know that unambiguously it would be good, because of what you said, the effects on self-awareness and understanding of role could definitely be there, but getting people reps with certain aspects of skill and also just in different roles and seeing the court in different ways and different places is definitely valuable. It's just the problem is that then becomes the evaluation. This thing that should like almost be a behind closed doors experiment becomes the entire subject of the evaluation. And then that is deeply intertwined with the future resources that are going to be expended on this player.
Yeah, I mean, so I would add, again, like Max, I haven't watched a ton of him specifically. I usually dive into the international guys after the college season. But what I will ask you, PD, is at some point with these bigs, they're getting thrown into situations that they're not typically accustomed to. So it's kind of like there's going to be some bad reps eventually. Do you think, and I know this is why I'm actually siding with Max, I actually don't think you have to fully eat crow on this, because my counter would be, what if he was getting these reps when he was 14 and 15 for the first time instead of when he was 19? So then when we get to the stage that Max is talking about in the pre-draft year, where the evaluation is intertwined with the development, he is a little bit more seasoned and comfortable making these roles. Making these decisions within the role, and it's not just getting thrown into the fire for the first time.
But it's always intertwined though, because you know, if you're 14 or 15 and doing this and at the same time, like there are all these biases that, favor bigs who demonstrate skill at a young age, even if they're not necessarily effective with that skill. It is still intertwined, because if you're 15 and doing this and it's not, it's not necessarily effective, it still could affect the resources that are allocated toward developing you in the future, because you're kind of, as a basketball prospect, I don't know how young it starts, but it starts really, really young. I mean, we've had PD on this podcast in the past talking about like literal 12-year-olds. It starts super young.
And so, I don't fully disagree with you 100%. Random example, let's say a 16-year-old's at an AAU tournament and he's trying to make short roll passes and 3 of them are turnovers. Like you said, that's going to limit the offers and the resources. So And that is ultimately, this is probably like the toughest thing I've had to battle with, like as an evaluator watching basketball from a developmental standpoint and an evaluative standpoint. I would love Moses Moody to run 15 pick and rolls for Arkansas in a game, but Arkansas wants to win and they want to win national championship. And that's not necessarily, that might not be feasible for their aspiration. So this kind of is like the $1 million question of how can we make this? And I don't have an answer for it. And I don't know if anyone does. Like you were saying, Max, it's sort of this, what should be happening behind closed doors in practices, but then kind of just gets shoved out onto the stage. And then we kind of all have to deal with it and evaluate and make conclusions from it. And I don't really know where to go with it, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, it's that this theory, like developing big men is messy. And the later that you try that a team or agent or, the player themselves tries to tack on skills, the messier it's going to be because the talent gap is smaller. Like we all watched the Evan Mobley senior year in high school experience. And we're like, I don't know what to do with this. Like, this is certainly not what I saw from him as a junior, not what we saw from him as a sophomore. But like some of those skills transferred. Like he mostly spent a year just trying to highball blocks, and like it transferred to the next level. But like the rest of the stuff didn't. Like the standard rotations, the games were, didn't feel like he was leaving as much of an imprint. I don't think that there's necessarily a solution for like when is the best time to experiment. Is it, when everything's certain? Or is it, when you're in a draft year? I just think that it is something that has to be seriously considered is, we all want the BAMs of the world, but like the process of making BAMs is extraordinarily messy from a applied development perspective. And at a certain point, if a guy is really trying to do those things in practice, you have to let him do them in a game, if only for the different approaches that opponents will throw versus teammates. It's just a thing that has jumped out to me, partially because the stats are so bad, and partially because, like, like Rubinov says, he's getting used like he's Siakam, but in reality, he's closer to just a big man, which is there's nothing wrong with that. It's just not something you usually see, because so much of how I think the American college system works is that you show your strengths and the promise that like some of your weaknesses will be solved, similar to Moses Moody, where Huck Porty seems to have taken the opposite approach of saying like, everyone knows my strengths, so why don't I try these new things in my draftable year and see how that plays out. It's interesting.
The wait is finally over. Football is in full effect and the NBA is back. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at Bet Online. Bet Online is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, Bet Online gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to Bet Online today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. Bet Online, your online sportsbook experts.
Yeah, I mean, Mobley is a worthwhile example because he probably managed this perfectly in that he had already established himself as an elite prospect. He, was a highly prized recruit who already had his, his destination chosen. And yeah, his senior year, his engagement level was generally not very high, and he kind of just tried stuff. And like Petey mentioned, some of the good stuff translated and very little of the bad stuff translated, but very few prospects find themselves in the position of Evan Mobley.
Or are as talented.
Mobley
can try so much more than basically everybody else because his talents are pretty limitless from a comparative perspective. But like, say to like your average like mid-major big who needs to have this process as well of like, they're not going to be Shaq even at a mid-major level, but they need to tack on skills. Like, when is the point where they start experimenting? Is it, once they've signed? Like, is it once they've, gone through the UIBL games that matter? That's such a fraught process for people who are not as talented as Evan Mobley. And the fact that like I can speak for myself and Max because it's on tape saying this, but like, we're all like, man, I have no idea what to do with the senior year. And like, we openly doubted like what this was supposed to be, because that could easily have been the story of like guy, kind of gets bored doing the things that he's extremely good at.
Yeah, it was really confusing. And that's for a guy who previously had demonstrated to be an exceptional player. And like you said, is like was uniquely positioned in terms of what he had to fall back on and just like his physical and mental capability, I think, to actually gain from that experience at that age, because he is such a like uniquely physically and intellectually talented guy. So yeah, it's not, I don't think that the Evan Mobley model is really replicable for anyone except for, you know, maybe one or two guys a year. And that's probably pretty generous. But yeah, doing the attempt at like throwing stuff at the wall to figure out if you can develop these skills in your draft year is tough. It's tough to know where you go from there, because with Mobley, it was tough to know where we went from there. And that was starting from a much more confident point.
Yeah. And I would definitely agree that it is only, that route is only serviceable for one at max two guys per year, especially when we're talking about non-guards. And I will just throw in his name because I feel like I'm obligated to. I think it's worth noting that Paolo Banchero is basically taking that route in his senior year from the film that I've seen. He's not necessarily suffering from the disengagement that Mobley is suffering from, but he is basically, I guess he's taking the approach of, look, everyone knows I can play the low man, I can be a weak side and even primary rim protector at times. I can do all the big man stuff. I can operate as the roller. So in the games I've seen this year and with Seattle Rotary, he's just kind of taking the Paul George role on offense and is running pick and rolls, is experimenting with different footworks and rhythms as a pull-up shooter. And it's been pretty mesmerizing to watch, honestly. And I'm really intrigued to see how much of it carries over to Duke in that context and how much of the guard wingy stuff he's enabled to do there and how that ties into his game as a prototypical four or five.
I really want to watch high school basketball again. I need to do that because it's the best. It's the best basketball. Do you guys want to talk about shooting now or in part two?
I would love to do it now just because I know the name we're going to talk about and I'm very excited to.
All right, let's do it now. Let's start with Kessler Edwards of Pepperdine, the forward. He's a weird shooter. PD, what do we think is going on there? Because like he's an effective shooter, but I think it's really apparent immediately that he's a weird shooter.
Yeah, so I can generally figure out how much draft film people have been watching based on their reaction to Kessler Edwards. If they're like, yeah, I don't know about this guy's, like, because it looks very strange. I would say in terms of technical, he has a big dip. He doesn't really involve his hips and he shoots out. It leads to this sort of like jangly leggedness that he seems like he's falling over quite a bit. There's, you know, questions about the utility. In terms of like, can he shoot them off the dribble? I mean, it's a quick release in terms of how long it takes to get out of his hands. But like people who just see it for the first time are like, yeah, I don't know if this is going to transfer to the league. An authoritative list of players who were drafted in the first round who are taller than 6'6", hit 38% of their threes and took at least 350 in college. Tell me the non-shooter in this group or questionable shooter. Doug McDermott, Luke Kennard, Sauce Castillo, Cal Bridges, Cam Johnson, Desmond Bain, Clay Thompson, Dylan Windler, Reggie Bullock, and Tony Snell.
Those would all be pretty reliable shooters, I would say. I mean, Sauce or Snell is the worst of that group, which is, you know,
yeah, still so you
pretty
have,
good. Pretty good.
And like Sauce had like the mental thing that happened. Where I don't think he was really like wired to stand in a corner and make, you know, that one shot that they needed. And Snell quietly is an extremely good shooter. If you look at the historical numbers, it just doesn't feel that way. That being said, like if you do any kind of historic backing and run his numbers across, you know, people of a certain size who have taken a certain amount, like it's basically an ironclad list. If you're worrying about changing it, you're worried you're altering a shooter's form because you don't like the way it looks. And at a certain point, there's not an additional point or
added or a subsequent point taken away for good looking jumper. It just goes in. These are the same sort of people who would have made adjustments to Kevin Martin's jumper, which looked how it looked, but the thing went through the net.
So, yeah, I mean, if you're confident in Kessler Edwards as a shooter, which it certainly looks like historically we probably should be, how worried are you that someone is going to be baited into trying to change it? I mean, I feel like we've seen that with at least one of these guys on your list in detail. And I do remember seeing concern over like Desmond Bain. I think that was a concern that some people raised, that, you know, even though it was 40 whatever percent on whatever sample over 4 years, that there was some concern raised over it. Like, I just with someone who is a good shooter but an unorthodox one, it has to be, I think, a real developmental hurdle potentially that someone could be baited into trying to change it.
I mean, the fact that people talked about changing Bane's jumper despite the fact that he shot 43% over his college career is pretty nuts to me. And like, I think it's just a matter of sitting down with the team and the pre-draft person just being like, this is a thing that is not on the table during this process. There are guys who say like, I'm not willing to change, you know, this thing that I do or that thing that I do. And I would strongly suggest that the people around, I guess I would say like the jumper is a non-negotiable, because it goes. And I think that a team that is willing to draft him in the first round, I would assume gets that. And it's just going to be like, look, I don't particularly love the way it looks, like cards on the table. But if it goes, like, that's not particularly important to me. Like, you're getting if Kessler Edwards had a normal looking jumper, he would be like a guaranteed top 20 guy, most likely.
Yeah. So this is actually perfect timing, because I was having this exact conversation with someone yesterday. Here are some Kessler Edwards shooting numbers for you over the past 3 years. So we'll go totals on 380 3-point attempts. He is shooting 39.5% from the free throw line. On 280 attempts, he's shooting 79%. And look, the only way to kind of go about this, in my opinion, is if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that is certainly not broke. And it's not like he's one thing that I think needs to be talked about here is how he's getting these jumpers and his usage as a shooter. There is versatility. He's comfortable with movement. There have been some pull-up flashes. As you mentioned, PD, it's somewhat of a quick trigger off the bounce. But yeah, I agree with you. This is something I'm not really worried about concerning. I'm not worried about changing, but it is a worthwhile concern with Max brought up. We've seen, I don't really know if we've even got to the bottom of the Vassell video that surfaced last year, but we've all seen what happened with Mikal. And player development staffs and NBA people and trainers love to put their own imprint on things. And we definitely know that. So while I'm not personally concerned about it, and I wouldn't touch it because the results are there, and it's not like we're talking about a non-shooter, even a mediocre shooter. Kessler has been a very good shooter for someone his size, and he has been for 3 years. So it's not something that I would necessarily touch, but I do think it's a worthwhile concern that Max brought to the table, that look, someone else could be thinking that, hey, if I can change XYZ, he could be at 42%. And in reality, I personally think that gamble isn't worth it at all, but it is likely on the table.
Yeah, I just worry a lot when, generally speaking, about, you know, like biases, like infecting development, I guess. And I think that like jump shot aesthetics have pretty clearly proven to be a pitfall at times. And so, yeah, like more so than anything else, you want a guy who like undeniably is a really good shooter. But even when you have that in Desmond Bane, like there will be people who point to the unorthodox aesthetics of it, and raise some concern over it. And I think you just have to consider that when thinking about these guys developmentally. The next guy that we have to talk about as a shooter is Evan Mobley. There's a lot to work with there as a shooter, even if he's not necessarily a great shooter right now. But beyond the just like hitting spot ups and pick and pop jumpers that he's already doing to an extent, PD, what are you doing to turn Evan Mobley into a off the dribble pull up threat?
Encouraging that he take more of them. He took 32 during the USC season. and was in the 78th percentile for those, grading out at 0.9 points per possession, which is this roughly the same as what he shot from three. Yeah, if you he needs to get a lot of this stuff. That's the only thing I could suggest. Like the jumper has extreme translatability because of how high the release point is. So I would just try to get some of those like 17 footers that he likes a little bit too much for my taste, just to be pull up threes. And in a lot of ways you can look at the mid-range success and say like, okay, this is proof of concept of his ability to stretch the range out further. It's something we've seen historically for guys who self-create mid-range jumpers, is that it is an indicator of the ability to potentially shoot pull-ups off the from the NBA line. Getting him in five out actions where he's encouraged to take a step towards the line and pull, getting him to bring the ball up in semi-transition, giving him DHO keepers that he can shoot, just running every action through him as a rookie, and just say like, look, you're gonna make mistakes, but these are the shots that we would really like it if you took. I don't think that there's that much more that he has to adjust with his form other than putting on leg strength, which is a thing that basically every 19-year-old, 20-year-old big man has to do anyway. Yeah, I would be surprised if he doesn't take a solid amount. If anything, my worry is that he'll have like a weird KG Rasheed Wallace thing about loving the 20-footer but not taking threes. But like that, if we're at that point of consideration, like we're already talking about something that's very special.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So you think it's a matter of just like in-game reps in a lot of different situations, and kind of back to the Huck Porty conversation, I guess, just letting him do, or forcing him to do things.
I would say forcing is a bit strong. I would say building an offensive infrastructure where it is encouraged, if not like what, basically to build a system where the defense is going to give him that shot and say like, it'd be wonderful if you did this. Like that's very easy to do. That's very easy to do with DHOs, where you get the guard downhill and the big is automatically going to sag. And it's like, wow, if you turn and take a jumper, like that'd be swell. That's a pretty easy thing to do in terms of overlapping your player development and your X's and O's on a night and night basis, but in encouraging the shots that you want. I think a lot of shot selection conversations don't touch on the X's and O's player development aspect, where it's like, if you want a guy to have good shots off the dribble, you build a system where it's really hard to take bad shots off the dribble, which is pretty easy to do. It just requires a more intelligent design of offensive concepts. And I think with Mobley and his strengths and weaknesses, it's very easy to set about a system where you can leverage his passing, his comfort in space. And then, you know, when teams sag off of him to prevent him from long limbing into the restricted area, it's like, hey, take that three every once in a while. Not every time. You don't have to suddenly turn into Steph, but like just take the ones that'll make them come out a little bit more.
Yeah, one thing I'll ask you about PD, I'm relatively confident in the actual mechanics translating and being functional off the bounce, off semi movement. But one thing I will ask you about is like sometimes with wiring with Mobley, it's not the most aggressive score first big man or even offensive engine. But we've seen him pass up some catch and shoot threes throughout the year and just not always like it's kind of. Whether he takes or not is whether he's in the mood to take them or not. How do you see that kind of progressing at the next level, and how realistic is it to maybe even like turn the corner on him becoming an aggressor as a scorer?
I think with that stuff, it's difficult because like what we label aggressiveness is not always how players internally, like every player has their own idea of how much they should shoot, or like what the offense requires, or, you know, sometimes you'll ask them like, hey, why didn't you take this catch and shoot three? And they're like, oh, we were trying to run this play or whatever. I think with Mobley, I think that he's like overthinks games at times where he's trying to let perfect be the enemy of good. It's not like one-to-one with Scotty, but like they're clearly processing the game rather than just like being like, oh, this is a good look, I'll take it. And in the NBA where those perfect looks rarely happen, guys have to settle into being like very good is often the best we'll get on this time down, so take it. I also think seeing guys who are of the same position that lack some of his skills getting like tons of threes up is just one of those things. It's like, oh, no one's going to yell at me, or no one's going to say like, get my big ass into the post. Like if I shoot 8 threes per game, no one's going to be upset because there's some, you know, 6'11" dude out here taking 12 per 36 or whatever.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and a broom. A performance-enhancing broom. My name is John Cullen. I'm a comedian, podcaster, and for 20 years, I was a semi-professional curler. And I want to tell you the story about how a single broom almost imploded the 500-year-old sport of curling.
We felt like we were bringing a knife to a gunfight.
It's the story of a superstar and his fall from grace.
Well, I was being dragged through the mud.
It's the story of two brother entrepreneurs with a dream.
I said, that's great news.
It's a story of intrigue.
I still don't understand why we want to keep his name secret.
The full story has never been told, so I'm going to tell it. Broomgate, how a broom almost killed curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
To listen to Broomgate, search for Broomgate in your favorite podcast app. That's all one word, Broomgate.
The NBA Finals are heating up. Looking for hot takes on all the postseason action? The Old Man and the Three, presented by BMW, is the podcast to listen to for the ultimate finals coverage. Host and former NBA sharpshooter J.J. Redick not only has a plugged-in perspective on the action from his time in the league, but he's also announcing the games in real time for ESPN. J.J. has the ultimate insider point of view, and he's taking you along for the ride as he breaks down the best defensive schemes, dunks, and drives from each game. And speaking of incredible drives, there's no better place to tune into your new favorite podcast, The Old Man and the Three, than in a standard-setting BMW. Luxury meets power to create a wholly new driving experience. Push the limits this NBA season with the brand that set the ultimate standard. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Moving on to a guy who I think the shooting maybe is less tied to these ceiling outcomes and maybe more necessary. Sharif Cooper, PD, how are you rebuilding or building from the ground up Sharif Cooper's jumper?
I think before we talk about building from the ground up, we kind of need to talk about like what's happening, because it's
there's
a lot of stuff going on with his jumper. The first thing that jumps out to me is that he shoots with a backwards tilt. So if you were to sort of imagine his jumper, like he's leaning, I'd say like 10 degrees backwards from each time he shoots. And that has a knock-on effect of his elbow angle is collapsed. He can shoot with sort of like an upper arm catapult. His gather point's kind of strange out of off the dribble shooting. And
do you think that all that came from like compensating for his size? Like, where do you think that came from?
Often it does. Like often it's just like something works well enough and they're comfortable with it. And again, it goes back to like, when do you think the last time Sharif Cooper wasn't supposed to win a basketball game was?
Like, that's a good question.
So like, if you've always been evaluated, if you're a kid who's a winner at like age 13, when are you supposed to rebuild that jumper?
That's a really good point.
So that's, I find, an often circumstance for guys, especially like of his mold, who have been good forever. is that like there wasn't a natural point where basketball was off to you know, take the percentage all the way down to zero, build it from scratch. Even a guy like Steph had to do it between, you know, a summer where he took off AAU and rebuilt his jumper from a two motion to the one motion. I think that the most important thing for me is that it's really laborious. It takes him a long time to get from the decision to shoot to the release. And of all the things, like, it's not the two motion, it's not the gather point. The laboriousness is the enemy to me because it feels like he's aiming every single shot. I think that the most important thing is getting the thinking out of the jumper and the aiming out of the jumper, and just to get it from the decision to shoot to a release point as quick as possible, whether that's through a two motion jumper, through a one motion jumper, through aiming the points, to me is not particularly important. It's about just saying like, look, you can throw a left-handed push pass with weight, like with basically like, it's he throws lobs that like I can only compare to like Cesc Fabregas, where it's just like, it's the perfect ball that like lofts. And like, you don't, when he throws it, sometimes you don't see the person he's throwing it to because they haven't even started jumping yet. Where it's like, the ball takes a second for you to process what he is seeing. And sometimes the other person's like, oh, that's a lob for me. And they have to go get it. Somebody with that level of touch, like, I refuse to believe can't shoot. And so I would just like to have be like, look, as easily as you throw that pass, I'd like you to shoot a basketball. So that to me is the long-term goal. And everything else is sort of extraneous to like how you believe shooting should work.
So in the short term, what do you think the play? I mean, it's if you're removing the issue of trying to win games, because I do think that's a really valid point. I mean, Sharif was obviously famously involved in that. However many years Isaac Okoro went without losing a game, you know, Sharif went the same number. Do you think it's just like drop him in the G League and then the rebuild can start, or what?
I would start the rebuild now. This is sort of a divisive concept between, you know, people, but like, do you rebuild with the ideas from, you know, the pre-draft trainer? Do you rebuild with the ideas that you have from somebody else? Like, obviously the Coopers are in a different sort of circumstance because like if Tia, that his dad is an agent, like this is a family of basketball royalty. So this isn't like, well, we'll trust, you know, whoever we hire to do the, you know, the spring and summer work. This is more a long-term basketball family that has their own ideas about the game. So I think that like I would trust them more long-term than I think other people in terms of the best decision about the jumper. I generally lean to like the person should make the choice if possible. The first thing I would do is just get that down to one motion. That seems the easiest just to reinforce some of the other points, because it's really hard to shoot a one motion shot cross body. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever tried to do that, or you're just like experimenting with different jumpers the same way that like, I know baseball players try to mimic each other's swings. I had a friend who shot cross body in one motion, and it was the hardest thing to clone because my elbow like would go completely sideways, and then the hand is like on the side of the ball. And I don't know how he did it, but it was just like an evil thing to try to like make jumpers with. So I think that if he did that with Sharif, he'd move you'd naturally move the shooting pocket a little bit to the right. You know, you'd get the gather point a little bit easier. And then the process, like it would solve the tilt problem long-term. I feel pretty good about his ability to iron it out to passable, just because like so much is weird and he's still not like awful. But that's something that bears mentioned. Like, I think for a smaller guy, he has one of the more difficult shots to get off, and it's still not horrendous. I think that getting a leg strength, lowering the point where he generates his power from, there's a lot of stuff that tells me he's not going to be like a bad shooter long term.
So, Petey, you kind of hit the nail on the question I was going to ask, which is basically the fact that he's in no man's land right now with these mechanics. In terms of what we typically see from small guards, you know, sometimes it's the Carson Edwards shot, which is this high elevating two motion jumper that generates a ton of power from the lower body, or you get the Steph mechanics, which is this, obviously not anyone or no one looks like Steph other than Steph, but this fluid one motion jumper that it all just, you're shooting on the way up and it all rises up as one, and that's how you get your power. Versus Cooper, he doesn't get a ton of elevation from his legs and it's two motion. So he's kind of taking the tougher parts from each end of the spectrum, if that makes sense. I personally agree with you that I think getting it down to one motion for him would make it quicker. It would speed the whole thing up. It would make him more on balance, and which would hopefully lead to better results. But what would your first point of action be? Because as we've all said, there's kind of a lot going on here. And just from a player development standpoint, I'm curious for your point of view, what would like the first course of action be in terms of getting this to the final product?
I mean, if we were just trying to like, I guess if we were trying to just like get it passable as quick as possible, like if for whatever reason we're like in a rush rebuild or we have to win a shooting contest in 2 weeks or whatever, getting him on balance where he's not shooting from this like backwards tilt seems like the most obvious thing. To me, that's the biggest remnant. It's not the two motion, it's the weird tilt that reminds me of the, like this was probably a jumper built when he was like 12 or 13, like the last time that he wasn't in serious competition. Obviously adjustments have been made. I mean, like it's a different jumper than what you saw his junior year of high school, but that to me seems like the lowest hanging fruit. I don't know if you would start with that developmentally, just like on thinking on process, but it's the thing that I think that has the highest rate of return of any single aspect of the jumper itself.
I think that's probably good for shooting and for part one of this. Unless you guys have anything to add, I think we could probably call this part one and then get started on part two.
Yeah, let's go with me.
All right. So you can follow the pod at Prep2ProPod on Twitter. You can follow Jake at Jake in the Paint, me at Max A. Carlin, PD at Above the Break 3. PD, anything to plug?
Yeah. If you guys have any time on April 14th at 9 p.m., I'm hosting a Twitch stream called How to Watch Film, where we are attempting to stream a full game of Josh Giddey's and show how I break down film, what I'm seeing. Involves some diagrams, some telestration, a lot of stats, a lot of re-rocked film. And it's going to be a nice, you know, 45-minute endeavor with a good 10 to 15-minute Q&A afterwards. I would really appreciate everybody coming by if possible. Be me and a guest. Be a good time.
That is going to be a fun time. And definitely looking forward to it. And with that, I think we can call this part one.